Today at Reader's Corner, sports writer Jason Turbo talking about his hit book, The Baseball Codes, Beanballs, Sign-Stealing, and Bench-Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime.
My own opinion is it's not so much a matter of the player's health as it is a matter of the fact that, you know, the owners have millions and millions and millions of dollars invested in these guys and don't want to see them headed toward the disabled list because of some hot-headed pitcher. The thing about baseball is it's such a kind of a leisurely sport. There's so much time between the things that take place on the field that players are allowed to imbue their actions with meaning. There's a clear moment when retaliation is called for and a pitcher does not retaliate for whatever the offense is, he instantly loses face in the clubhouse.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The end of winter means spring training, a sneak peek at the Major League Baseball season to come. Most fans will only notice big hits and runs on the board, but those in the know will be watching for pine tar on the pitcher's fingers, flaming shoes in the dugout, and sanctioned fastballs rocketing toward unprotected ribs. These details barely scratch the surface of baseball's collection of unwritten rules. It is the code that governs everything from stealing bases to brawling in center field, not to mention pulling the kind of clubhouse pranks that make history. In The Baseball Codes, now out in paperback, sports writer Jason Turbo takes informed and uninformed fans alike into the insular world of baseball's secret and sacred culture. Through the original stories of some of the toughest and most colorful characters in American sports, he pays tribute to the unique value system that made baseball what it is today and examines its chances of survival in the modern era. A regular contributor to Giants Magazine and former content director for the San Francisco Chronicle's Giants Today, Mr. Turbo has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Slam Magazine, and SportsIllustrated.com. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he joins us today by phone. Jason Turbo, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hello, Bob. That was a heck of an introduction. Thank you.
Well, there's the official rules of baseball. We all know those. Even people who aren't fans know about singles and doubles and triples and stealing, advancing the runners, foul balls versus fair balls. But then there's the baseball codes. Tell us what those are and how they differ from those official rules that almost all of us know something about.
Well, the short story is that it's essentially the moral code by which players police themselves and each other. And ultimately, it comes down to a matter of respect. You respect your teammates, you respect your opponents, and above all, you respect the game itself. And the thing about baseball is it's such a kind of a leisurely sport. There's so much time between the things that take place on the field that players are allowed to imbue their actions with meaning. You know, a guy stealing a base might be nothing more than a guy stealing a base, but he might be trying to send a message with that stolen base. And over the course of a century, those meanings have become well established, and players are really attuned on how to receive them. So, for example, you know, the most common of the unwritten rules is you don't steal a base with a big lead late in the game. The notion is you don't want to show up the other team. There's some gray area when it comes to defining what a big lead is and when late in the game is, which is where bad blood arises. So if someone steals a base late in the game, the other team could take it as a message of disrespect, at which point they have to decide how to respond, and there's a whole series of codes related to that. So it can get pretty complex and involved, especially when there's differences of opinion, and there's always differences of opinion.
Now, quite a few of the revelations that we read about in your book, The Baseball Codes, seem to come from books that have been written by ex-players or interviews that you've had with ex-players, or maybe some of the research that you pulled off in Cooperstown. You gave credit to the Cooperstown staff, I believe, in your acknowledgments. I'm curious as to how easy it is to get this kind of information about these informal rules from the guys that are playing the game today, as opposed to all these veterans who are now willing to talk about it since they're no longer on the field.
Right. Well, it was a learning process for me as well. You know, the book took about 5 years to research and write. And I learned not too far along that current players don't like speaking philosophically about non-specific issues. You know, when you ask them, how do you feel about respect and how do you feel about, you know, the concept of someone showing you up, it's difficult to get anything out of them, by and large. Ex-players, however, I found very quickly, you know, when talking to the managers and the coaches and the broadcasters and the scouts and, you know, everyone who passed through the ballparks I was in, this is the thing that the code, the unwritten rules, embodies the game they grew up playing. It's the game they learned. It's the game they love. And they were really very willing to talk about it in very specific detail. You know, and looking back, I kind of realized that it might be their way of holding on to it, of, you know, perpetuating this code that has, you know, frankly, disintegrated a little bit over the years. You know, it's not nearly as prevalent now as it was 30 years ago. It's still there, don't get me wrong, but, you know, modern players, for a variety of reasons, don't view it quite the same as their predecessors. So these ex-players would talk to me, you know, especially the ones who are still around teams, and give me details of events that involve current players, at which point I could then go back to the current players and say, hey, here's a specific. Can you tell me what was going through your head? And those answers became much more ready on their lips.
Well, you mentioned the modern player. The modern player today, of course, could be a kid who leaves high school and goes into the minors. The modern player could be a kid who goes on to college and works his way right on up to the College World Series and then gets drafted. The modern player could be from the Latin leagues, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, two countries where there are strong baseball traditions. Let's just take those two for a moment. And, of course, Japan, Ichiro, my Mariners hero. Let's just take Japan, Venezuela, and Dominican Republic. When those players come into the majors, and maybe they'll pick some of it up in the minors, but do they carry with them the same code book that American players learn growing up in the minors, or do they have to learn that coming over to the American major leagues?
Yeah, they don't carry that same code book, and it's definitely a learning process. I think the Japanese and other Asian players have an easier time of it because they have their own specific code book, and it's much more stringent than the American one. So they're, you know, generally if they err, it's going to be, you know, on the side of not inspiring an opposing pitcher to throw at them. The Latin players, they have their own codes too. It's not as stringent as in America. So it really is a quick learning process once they get up here. You know, sometimes that happens in the minor leagues. A shocking amount of times, it doesn't happen until they get to the major leagues. And, you know, if they're lucky, it'll be a teammate kind of sitting them down saying, look, you don't need to do that up here. That's going to get you or someone on this team hurt. And if they're not lucky, they're going to get hit. You know, I'm reminded of a story from the early 90s when Roger Cedeno, then a young player with the Dodgers in his first full season, stole a base against the Giants. I think the score was 11-0 in the ninth inning, and he took off for second. There was no throw, and the Giants players just erupted. I mean, Matt Williams had to be restrained from going after him. Mel Hall came over from right field to yell at him. Dusty Baker was screaming at him from the dugout. And the guy who was most angry at him was Eric Karros, his own teammate, Dodger first baseman, who happened to be at the plate at the time and who realized that he suddenly had a target on his back because of something, you know, his young teammate had just done without thinking about it. And while everyone was busy screaming at Cedeno at second base, Karros walked over to the Giants dugout and assured them that the Dodgers would take care of this internally and that they had his assurance. And that was enough. That bought him the leeway. He was not thrown at that at bat. He was not thrown at the next game. And sure enough, after that game, when reporters were let into the clubhouse, no one was talking. And Cedeno certainly wasn't talking, but it was clear to everyone who was there that he had been crying. And I actually talked to Karros about this during the postseason last year. And he said, yeah, you know, you can't do that because you're going to put your teammates in harm's way. And if you're going to play that thoughtlessly, you need to be taken down a rung.
You know, you mentioned that he was crying. One of the things that I walked away from your book with is this incredible understanding of the humanity involved in this game. Yeah, there's cheating. Yeah, there's beanballs. We can talk about some of these things if we have time. But the humanity in it just really got to me. First of all, you tell some of the funniest stories, and anybody who cares at all about baseball will want to read this book just to follow the incredible research you've done in finding these stories, sometimes hilarious, sometimes otherwise. But, for example, you tell the story of Frank Robinson violating the rule that says you don't pull a pitcher in the middle of the inning.
Yep.
And he tells that story. You can finish it, but I mean, I just thought his reaction was incredible.
Well, he pulled his catcher.
That's right.
The rule is you don't pull a player in the middle of an inning,
yeah,
except for a pitcher, except for the case of injury.
Right.
His catcher was Matt LaCroix, who was playing only because the Nationals teams that Robinson was managing had this string of injuries at catcher. LaCroix had an injured arm and was next to useless behind the plate. And I believe they were playing the Astros. And the Astros, it took a couple innings for them to catch on that LaCroix really couldn't throw. But once they did, they just started running wild. And they were abusing the guy. Like, he was helpless behind the plate through no fault of his own. and they stole something like 7 bases against him in the course of a couple innings, and Robinson felt he had no choice but to come and, you know, and take LaCroix out of the game.
To relieve him. It was for the good of the catcher.
The good of the catcher, the good of the team. And when Robinson addressed it after the game, he just started crying. He understood that, you know, part of it was that he had put LaCroix into that situation in the first place, forcing him to then embarrass LaCroix by yanking him from the game in the middle of the inning. He didn't like any of it. And it all just got to him all at the same moment while he was addressing it to the media.
And sticking with the humanity theme, it's 1968, and the young Denny McLain is facing Mickey Mantle.
Well, the young Denny McLain had a hero growing up, and that hero was Mickey Mantle. So he couldn't have been more delighted. Mickey Mantle was right toward the end of his career. He was approaching a milestone home run. And, you know, there was some fear on McLain's part that Mantle might not make it there before the end of the season, you know, when everyone expected him to retire. So he sent word along through his catcher, you know, tell Mickey to tell me where he wants the ball, and I'll put it there. Sure enough, you know, a surprised Mickey Mantle then held out his bat right to the part of the strike zone he wanted it. McLain put it right there, and Mantle hit a home run. And the guy clapping loudest on the field for him was none other than Denny McLain.
I mean, given how competitive the game is, it's just so hard to believe when you hear a story like that. We don't go to the ballpark oftentimes thinking that the pitcher is serving the opposing team up with a ball the batter can hit a home run with.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very frequently. And, you know, if it ever does happen, it's almost inevitably in a game that's already out of hand.
And on the competition angle, of course you expect the team to be competitive. You expect the team members to hang together when it comes to enforcing the code. But it's really interesting when you give examples of veteran players enforcing the code against members of the opposing team that really has no bearing on the outcome for the team. And I think of your example of Carlton Fisk ripping Deion Sanders for not running out the ball, I believe it was.
Yeah, well, you know, Neon Deion had the benefit of being a fully formed character before he got to the big leagues. He was, you know, famous for playing football, both in college and with the Atlanta Falcons before he ever made his big league debut. So he stepped to the plate, and, you know, he was audacious enough to draw dollar signs in the dirt with his bat when he came up to the plate. So he popped up a ball and just watched it, had, you know, no interest in running it out. And I would guess that he didn't understand who was behind the plate, because Carlton Fisk was one of the premier red asses of baseball, certainly by that point in his career. You know, he was just a few years from retirement. He was probably in his late 30s or even early 40s. And he just started screaming at Deion, run it out. And, you know, Deion didn't take well to it. And the next time he came to the plate, he made some comment about how, you know, the days of slavery are over. And, of course, you know, suddenly there's a big brawl. I think Fisk would admit that, you know, the way he handled it was not perhaps the smoothest of ways.
Well, you had to clean up on the language front, because when you read the book, you get Fisk's colorful approach to Deion.
Yeah, you know, it's funny about this book. I have, you know, people telling me they buy it for their 10-year-olds and their 12-year-olds. And I think it's a great book for everybody, except for the fact that ballplayers curse an awful lot.
That's right.
And, I've not edited much of that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the unwritten rules, the thing that's so fascinating is how these are learned, whether everybody learns them at the same pace. Obviously, the answer to that is no. And last year, I think it was, when A-Rod was running from first to third on a fly ball that eventually turned foul, he had to return to first. Instead of retracing his steps from third to second to first, he ran straight across back to first and walked over the pitcher's mound.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about that. He didn't actually run straight back to first over the pitcher's mound. He went out of his way to cross the pitcher's mound. That incident surprised me, the aftermath, because I saw pundits on TV, you know, ex-players, talking about how they'd never heard of this rule and how it surprised them, and they didn't understand how anyone, let alone a pitcher like Dallas Braden, could be upset at it. But, you know, having been researching this very topic for, you know, for 6 years, I had heard all about it from any number of players. I had a dozen interviews in the can of pitchers talking about how they would not tolerate a hitter running across their mound. So unfortunately, when I was cutting down chapters right before the final edit, that was one chapter that my editor and I agreed would have little bearing on the reality of baseball, because it almost never happens. So, of course, it didn't make the book. And a couple months after the book comes out, here's the biggest story in the unwritten rules in many, many years. part of the reason it was so intriguing was that it was Alex Rodriguez, you know, the biggest name in baseball, playing for the biggest team in baseball with the Yankees, taking liberties against Dallas Braden, a guy who few people outside the Bay Area had heard of, in Oakland, you know, one of the smallest market teams, and Braden held his ground. Yeah, he came out with a ton of comments afterwards saying, you know, if he wants to run across mountains so bad, he should go do laps in the bullpen. He hit right to the point saying, you know, I have no business walking over to the plate and scuffing the dirt in his batter's box when he's there. That's his batter's box. Similarly, it's my mound, and he's got no business being on it. You know, Bob Gibson felt that way back in the day. He called the mound his office, and he didn't like his own catcher coming to the mound to talk to him, let alone an opposing player. So, you know, I love that Dallas Braden did that. You know, I took a lot of heat from various Yankees fans over the course of the ensuing months for my comments on it, but I think everyone else in baseball sort of appreciated it also.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Jason Turbo. He is the author of The Baseball Codes, Beanballs, Sign-Stealing and Bench-Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime. Jason, pitchers are the really placed in the role of the protector. They're the ones that are responsible for retaliating for the wrongs done to teammates. Help us through this concept and how it works in baseball today.
There's a lot of ways to retaliate on a baseball diamond. You know, as a middle infielder, you can throw the ball low. It's called low bridging. When a runner's coming into second base, you can lay down hard tags. There's a lot of ways to get someone back, but the most obvious way and the clearest way and the most prevalent way is for the pitcher to, you know, either brush a guy back or knock him down, or in extreme cases to drill him. And this becomes very important as a means of deterrent. If Team A is taking liberties against Team B by, you know, running up the score, by pimping their home runs, meaning, you know, hitting a home run and watching it go over the fence for too long, whatever the disrespect is, if Team B does not respond, then Team A is just going to keep doing it. It's sort of like a bully on the playground. And with that in mind, teams expect that their pitchers are going to do something about it. And if there's a clear moment when retaliation is called for and a pitcher does not retaliate for whatever the offense is, he instantly loses face in the clubhouse. You know, and that's a really hard thing to undo. You know, to get that respect back takes a long time and a lot of effort, and some guys can never do it. And you'll see pitchers drill guys not because they want to all the time, but because they know it's their duty and because they know their teammates are expecting them to do it.
Well, this has changed somewhat over the years. I think you gave one case in the book, and I don't remember who it was, that literally threw the first pitch at each batter until they finally ejected him. This was years ago.
That was Doc Ellis. That actually
Doc Ellis, yeah.
That wasn't a case of retaliation. Let's definitely get back to this retaliation, but this is a good story.
Okay.
Doc Ellis pitched for the Pirates in the early 70s, and they were, you know, a very successful team in the early 70s. But they had a little bit of a rough stretch in 74. They had finished 500 the year before, and they got off to a 6-12 start in 74. And Ellis came to the conclusion that they were not playing well because they lost their swagger. And that, you know, the reason for their previous success had been that they were the cockiest team in the league. And he saw that the team that had taken their swagger was the Cincinnati Reds. This was the nascent Big Red Machine, which was about to go on and win a
sure.
couple World Series. And Ellis's solution was to go out and drill every member of the Reds he faced, in a way of trying to intimidate them back. And sure enough, he drilled Pete Rose, he drilled Joe Morgan, he drilled Dan Dreesen, and by that time the bases are loaded. He's facing Tony Perez, and Perez is no dummy. He sees what's going on, and he just stays very light on his feet and manages to avoid four straight pitches. And Ellis went 2-0 on Johnny Bench, who similarly avoided two straight pitches and was yanked. And the notion of intimidation in this game and what it can do for a team is obviously very nebulous. You can't put a statistic behind it. And there's no guaranteeing what his actions did for the Pirates that year, but the team that had started 6-12 went on to win the National League East for the third time in four seasons. So it had some effect.
So whether it's intimidation or whether it's retaliation, how do the umpires look at this problem, if you want to call it a problem? I guess it depends on how you view this thing. How do they look at this business of pitchers going after batters today in 2011 as opposed to years ago. Obviously, this is dangerous stuff. You can take somebody out of the career. That's happened a few times. You can kill somebody. That's happened once or twice. I mean, in the major leagues anyway. Mm-hmm. So in 2011, just like in so many other areas, we wear seatbelts now. We didn't wear seatbelts a long time ago. Is Major League Baseball looking at this and telling umps to tighten it up a little bit and police these pitchers a little more carefully, or is it same old unwritten rules?
Nope, you are absolutely right. They are policing it more closely than ever, although my own opinion is it's not so much a matter of the player's health as it is a matter of the fact that, you know, the owners have millions and millions and millions of dollars invested in these guys and don't want to see them, you know, headed toward the disabled list because of, you know, some hot-headed pitcher who may have it out for them. So the umpires are definitely policing it more strongly than ever. You look back at guys like Don Drysdale and Bob Gibson who would knock down, you know, a hitter for digging into the batter's box, you know, let alone, you know, real disrespect. You know, even Nolan Ryan. Nolan Ryan made a habit during his career of, before he threw the first pitch, going to tamp down the grass around the area in front of home plate while he was staring daggers into the opposing dugout. And his message to the other team was, don't you dare bunt on me. I'm not going to put up with it. And sure enough, no one bunted because all it took was a few bruised ribs on a couple guys and the message was sent. These days, it's not so easy to do. Umpires have a very short leash. They issue warnings sometimes almost immediately. Not many players are a fan of the warning system, or at least the quick trigger of the warning system. Some umpires will actually let the first one go so the other team has a chance to retaliate, and then they'll issue the warning. Either way, it plays itself out quickly, if at all, and there's little chance for protracted battles. That said, when you talk about guys, you know, being killed on the field or being seriously injured, there are codes and unwritten rules for how to drill a guy. You know, a lot of guys, you'll see players get drilled intentionally below the waist, on the hip, you know, on the butt, and they'll just trot down to first base as if they just drew a walk. You know, it's not a big deal. That kind of thing happens all the time. It's when pitchers start coming up around the shoulders and near the head that players lose their minds, and rightfully so. Dave Henderson told me he was drilled hundreds of times, and he was only hit above the neck twice, and everything else didn't count. So that's the one area where there's no leeway.
You have a line at the end of the book where you say players no longer are burning as hot as they once did, and then you go on to give a fairly substantial quote from Bob Gibson, the great Cardinal pitcher who wrote the book Stranger to the Game after he retired, I guess. Help us through some of Gibson's thinking. I mean, you touched on it in terms of today these players are worth so much that the owners have more of a stake in this. The players have more of a stake in it. And it has affected the game in many ways.
Yeah, well, the players do have more of a stake. You know, they've got millions of dollars on the line. They've got the chance to, you know, set up their family for life. But part of not burning as hot is the fact that, you know, guys jump from team to team to team so frequently now that inevitably someone knows someone else in the other dugout all the time. They share agents. They do charity events together. They go on off-season vacations together. They're friends. You know, you never used to see ball players glad-handing each other around the batting cage. You know, that was strictly forbidden. Back in the day, you know, when players had to work off-season jobs and stayed with the same team for their entire career, they were taught that the other team is the enemy, and there's no intermingling. I mean, Bob Gibson alone, heck, he had friends on his team that the moment they were traded, he wasn't talking to them anymore. You know, maybe in the off season, but certainly not when the teams were playing each other. So what was once a natural animosity, you know, a sportsmanlike animosity, but an animosity nonetheless, I don't want to say it's artificial these days, but it's, like you said, it doesn't burn as hot. Mm-hmm. People need other sources of motivation to get that fire burning.
So we can't begin to cover all of the unwritten rules you talk about in here. Sign stealing, to me, is one of the most interesting. And, again, it's sometimes moral and sometimes immoral as far as the code is concerned. Can you kind of sum that up for us as to when it's okay and when it isn't?
Sure. At their essence, signs are a way for the team to communicate from the dugout to the field or from the pitcher to the, or from the catcher to the pitcher, whatever play they want to run, whatever pitch they want to throw. If the opposing team can decode those signs, well, good on them. That essentially just means that the first team needs better signs, and almost everybody understands that. It's when teams are too blatant about it that things can go south. For example, when a runner's on second base, he has a clear view into the catcher's signs to the pitcher. And in those instances, the catchers and pitchers will switch up their signs and make it more complicated. But still, they can't make it so complicated that they don't understand it themselves. They can be picked. They can be understood. Base runners will then signal the hitters what is coming. There's leeway. Other teams will deal with that a little bit and tolerate that a little bit. But if a guy is too blatant about it, messages will be sent. Sometimes it's just a matter of telling them to knock it off. Sometimes it's a pitcher throwing a ball inside at them. Where it's really not okay is when teams take it beyond the field of play and start using spyglasses and telescopes.
Didn't you give an example of one team? It might have been your Giants, I'm not sure, that put a couple of guys up in the bleachers?
That was the Cubs.
The Cubs. Oh, okay. My Cubs, not your Giants.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing about the Cubs. The Cubs, all through the 60s, were known as one of the most sign-stealing teams in all of baseball. And other teams tolerated it because even though they had the signs, they still couldn't win. But, yeah, I mean, the Giants are famous for stealing signs that way, you know, and for the shot heard around the world and all the lead-up to that. They had an intricate camera system or a buzzer system at the Polo Grounds where someone would sit in the center field clubhouse, which was looking right down onto the field, and buzz into the bullpen depending on what the pitch was, and they would in turn signal the hitter, and the Giants went on this crazy run after they installed this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if that was found out today, there would be a huge uproar. I'm sure it would have been a huge uproar then, but they didn't find out about it for another 40 or 50 years.
Right. Of all the unwritten rules you've dissected in the book, and you've done a great job, which remains the most interesting?
You know, I'm personally partial to the old-timey ones that might have even been marginal 40 years ago and have almost no place in the game now. I think my favorite is you don't swing at the first pitch after back-to-back home runs. And this was huge with Hal McRae and Sparky Anderson and those great Reds teams of the 70s. And the notion is, you know, a pitcher who's just given up that back-to-back home runs is just trying to find his footing a little bit. He needs to find the strike zone. He's going to put one over. You give him the respect of that leeway. Let him pour one in and regain his footing. And as I talk to current players about that, I mean, not only do they disagree with it, they've never even heard of it. And, you know, a good number of players from the 70s had never heard of it either. So I just like the extension of the respect, how people go to the nth degree to establish comportment on the field. And really, it's just sportsmanship at its greatest.
Well, Jason, this has been a real pleasure for me. And I must say that the book itself is an incredible insight. It's entertaining. It's informative. You've really told a great story here. And I want to remind our listeners, it's The Baseball Codes, Beanballs, Sign Stealing and Bench Clearing Brawls, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime, now out in paperback. Jason Turbo, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks a lot, Bob. It's been great.
Next week, Pat Duggins, author of Trailblazing Mars, NASA's Next Giant Leap. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Aaron Ryan. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.